Set case on our docket, case number 09-SC-828, David Lee Cropper versus the people of the state of Colorado. Both the petitioner and respondent present, ready? Thank you. One preliminary matter I want to bring to your attention is Justice Marquez may participate in this case. Should say Justice Designate Marquez may. She'll be sworn in on December 10th and join the court absent some issue of conflict, which I have no idea. She would listen to the oral tapes of the argument and then participate as a regular court member. So with that, we're set for half an hour argument. Appreciate it if when you start your argument that you please state your name and whom you represent. Thank you. We're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. My name is Rebecca Frey, right number 20010. I'm a Deputy State Public Defender appearing this morning on behalf of Mr. Cropper, the petitioner. This case presents the issue of defense counsel's waiver of the right to confrontation under the LAB statute, and more specifically, whether defense counsel's presumptive knowledge of that statute under all circumstances and in every case means that her inaction under that statute is a valid waiver of her client's confrontation rights. That is, that it's a strategic decision, it's a knowing, voluntary, intentional waiver, you know, host Mendoza suggests, or whether some inquiry into the reasons for that inaction are needed to establish whether that decision was voluntary and knowingly made and intentionally made, as the Mojica Simmental case suggests. I am not challenging the constitutionality of this statute on its face, and I just want to make that clear because I know that the state characterizes my arguments as a facial challenge, and it's not, but I am challenging the application of this statute to my client, and I believe it was applied.
So why is that duty of the court to ask counsel whether or not counsel has taken advantage of this statute or not? I mean, this is a right that counsel can waive, right?
Absolutely. The right of confrontation isn't personal to the defendant, and it is a right that defense counsel can waive. But it's only a valid waiver if it is a knowing, intentional, voluntary decision, and the waiver law with respect to constitutional rights is the same, whether it's the defendant waiving the right or whether it's defense counsel waiving it on behalf of the defendant. So I don't see a problem with the court asking whether there was compliance.
Well, there's no problem, but is there a duty? I mean, the statute has been in place quite a while. The procedure is well known. People that practice in the area should be aware of it.
I guess I'm not really understanding the full question.
Well, I'm having trouble understanding your argument, I guess, you know.
Well, let me start.
I mean, the statute is there.
Apparently
there's some confusion about what the statute intended.
Well, the statute doesn't, while it notifies defense counsel that these reports are admissible, the same as live testimony, which is contrary to the well-established rule in Crawford and Melendez-Diaz, okay? So that raises some red flags.
But this has to do with a notice to the state to bring the authenticating witness to the trial.
Exactly. And the statute doesn't speak as to what the prosecutor's intent is with respect to a particular case. Okay? That's the problem, is defense counsel doesn't know. The statute doesn't inform defense counsel. The statute doesn't say you can presume in every single case that we're proceeding by report rather than by live testimony, when in fact, in reality, that's not what happens. Prosecutors usually, 90% of the time, call these forensic witnesses because they give compelling testimony. They're very persuasive in front of a jury. And so the rule is live testimony. That's what Crawford requires. That's what Melendez-Diaz requires. And LRAT statute was enacted back in 1984. Shortly after Ohio v. Roberts, when the thinking about these kinds of reports was they're neutral And because they're neutral, they're reliable, and because of trial considerations, we can relax the right of confrontation to accommodate.
I thought the prosecution gave notice that they weren't going to produce the witness.
No, not in this case. In fact, the prosecution gave notice of the opposite. What the prosecution intended from 4 months before trial up to the morning of trial was to proceed by live testimony. And this isn't a case like in Ojos Mendoza, where there was no intent expressed. It's not a case where defense counsel didn't know about this statute. She knew about it. And when she was making her motion for mistrial, which was the next day, when she tendered the court the Mojica Simmental case, what she said, and I'm quoting from volume 3, page 23, quote, "And if I had any clue that the district attorney was not intending to call these witnesses, we certainly would have filed the motion." But what she was told before the trial started was, "We intend to provide this live testimony." She had no reason to file notice under the statute. And I think to interpret the statute in a way that first of all, presumes the right of confrontation doesn't exist as to these reports, and then requires a defendant to activate the right of confrontation, I think that reading of the statute would be unconstitutional. Taylor v. Illinois, an old U.S. Supreme Court case, says the right of confrontation is automatically activated upon initiation of the adversarial process, and a defendant does not have to take any action to activate that right.
Frary?
Yes.
I think you suggest in your brief that I guess my real question is, do we have to, to rule in your favor, do we have to overrule, I can't pronounce it, I'm sorry,
Mendoza.
Yes, thank you.
To the extent that Hinojos Mendoza presumes that counsel's inaction in every case without inquiry into the reasons for the inaction constitutes a valid waiver, yes, I think so.
That's because you read United States Supreme Court case as a notice waiver requirement, constitutional requirement?
Sure. I think,
is that crystal clear?
In Melendez-Diaz, the holding wasn't that it is crystal clear. I think what Justice Scalia said is that simple notice and demand statutes, those that require the prosecution to state its intent pre-trial and then require the defendant to exercise the right of confrontation or to forego that, that's okay, because all you're doing is changing the timing of the objection. Normally with live testimony, counsel is listening to what's going on and is making decisions based on all the information as it's occurring during the trial. But when you're going to have this objection occur before the trial, counsel still needs all the information, and part of that information is knowing how the prosecutor is going to proceed with their case. Do they want to proceed by report, or do they want to call the live witness? So I think that is crucial, and because our statute doesn't have that notice requirement in it, it can be applied unconstitutionally, as it was in this case.
Could I ask, is that that notice requirement that we don't separately have, would that be sufficient, do you think, to establish a waiver? And what would that notice have to look like?
Well, I think the statute could be amended to require the prosecution to provide notice of intent within a certain amount of time.
Meaning like calling them or sending a letter or something?
Written notice would be fine. And whatever. I mean, the statute, that's the legislature's determination as to how. But it should provide for notice that's clear, and then provide for the defendant to respond accordingly, depending on his intent. And I don't know. I think you could then infer, okay, that procedure would allow a trial judge to infer that the failure to act was a knowing, voluntary, intentional decision.
And that's kind of what I was getting at. I'm kind of intrigued at you suggesting that even if it's a matter that's within the tactical discretion of the attorney, that nevertheless it has to be an intelligent waiver. So would that suggest, in the same sense that we've dealt with Curtis and all of these other questions of waiver by an individual defendant when the right is personal to him, that nevertheless, even if there were this kind of notice and it was required by the statute, that there would still have to be a separate factual determination by the trial court that the attorney actually made a voluntary and intelligent waiver of a right to confront?
I think the Christie case suggests that, because Christie is a case that said defense counsel is presumed to know the law. But if you go on, the next sentence is, nonetheless, the court's got to inquire about whether the defendant here, and maybe that's because it's a personal right, I don't know, but I think it depends on the circumstances.
Doesn't that cut across the notion that it's a tactical decision and it's the lawyer's decision, not the client's?
It does. But I don't know. We don't have a notice provision. I think that it would be much easier to infer a knowing, voluntary, and intentional waiver. I hesitate to say that's the case, that would be true in every single case, because it may be that the defense counsel never got that notice for some reason. I mean, there may be other circumstances for defense counsel, even though the prosecution gave notice, that they didn't really get it. And so that would be my only hesitation.
But it does seem clear, if I can just understand, then the thrust of your argument is that simply having a statute that requires defense counsel to do this is inadequate.
Correct. I think it is. I think
so that's not enough for the counsel to be on notice, simply the fact that he's told he has the obligation to request the witness to appear.
Right. Particularly in light of the facts in this case, when defense counsel is told, we're bringing in the live witnesses. They filed a notice of endorsement 4 months before trial that says we expect these witnesses to testify. That's consistent with Rule 16. You have to disclose the people you intend to call at trial. Then at the pretrial conference 2 weeks before the trial, the prosecutor is the one that's moving for the continuance because she's unable to provide the live testimony. And it was the judge who said, well, why don't you get somebody else to review it, because I've got this docket where I've got trials set 14 and 15 deep. It wouldn't be convenient for us to reset this trial. I'm denying it. The parties exchanged good faith witness lists. The whole purpose of a good faith witness list is so that you can plan who is going to be called in what order, and as a defense lawyer, so that you can plan your classes accordingly.
Would that seem to be a more narrow and different basis for us to decide this case if what we felt was this was a situation in which misrepresentations were made to defense counsel, or he was deceived in some way?
That would be a narrower way that it could be decided on. I don't think the prosecutor was deceiving this defense counsel. I don't think that there was any deception going on. I think what happened is that she found out the morning of trial, I've got this witness who's out of state. What am I going to do? Oh, defense counsel never filed notice under the statute. Here's what I can do. I'm just going to introduce it under the statute. So I don't think that's deception. I think that's really taking advantage of the situation, but she's got to prosecute her case. So I don't view that as being deceptive. But it's exactly the trial by ambush scenario that Pamela Metzger talks about in her law review article, Cheating the Constitution. This is kind of what happens when you don't know what the prosecution's intent is. But unfortunately, in this case, even when defense counsel knew what the prosecutor's intent was, all of a sudden it changed the morning of
trial. Well, to save the application of the statute, then the presumption should be in favor that the prosecution will produce the witness. And if you're real close to trial, and they say, well, sorry, not there, then what's the consequence of that?
Well, you continue the trial.
Right. And if you're up against speedy trial, that's just the problem.
Yeah.
That they have to bear.
I mean, yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, you can get continuances beyond speedy trial for good cause. And I think that it was easy to establish in this case. I mean, she had no idea until the morning of trial that this witness had flown out of state on his family emergency. So I think any judge would have been able to.
Well, there was another witness. Now, why isn't that witness adequate?
You know, because he didn't do the testing. I think Crawford makes really clear that, you know, testimonial evidence can only be, the reliability of it is only be tested in the crucible of cross-examination. And Justice Scalia and Melendez-Diaz said we cannot, the Confrontation Clause is binding. It cannot be disregarded for our convenience. That's a pretty strong statement, and that's what happened in this case. The Confrontation Clause was disregarded for the convenience of prosecuting this case by the prosecutor. It was disregarded by the court because he couldn't reset this case, and he had a busy docket. And that's not acceptable under the Sixth Amendment, under our Constitution, and under Melendez-Diaz and Crawford. It just isn't. And that's what happened. So for all of those reasons, I would ask you to reverse Mr. Crawford's convictions, and I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fair. Respondents?
May it please the court, my name is Deborah Perrett, attorney number 13803. I'm an assistant attorney general and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. The defendant's claim is that lab reports admitted against him at trial without testimony from the person who wrote the report violated his right to confrontation. Although the defendant claims over and over that he is not claiming that the statute is constitutional on its face. He's claiming, on the other hand, that the statute didn't give him proper notice of the contents of the report, along with a note on top of it that he's got so many days to request that those people testify in person. I take that to be a challenge to the constitutionality of the statute, and that's not properly in front of this court. The statutory issue that this statute somehow needed to be more was raised for the first time in the Court of Appeals. And the challenge to the constitutionality of the statute can only be raised for the first time in the trial court. And what counsel did here was just express surprise and misapprehension about what the statutory provisions really were. Secondly, the defendant doesn't have standing to challenge the issue of notice regarding the admissibility of the DNA results. There are a couple of results that were admitted here by report. There was hair and fingerprint analysis that basically said we didn't find anything, nothing against the defendant. I'm not going to talk about those because those don't really have anything to do with the right of confrontation. There was the shoe print evidence that was exculpatory to the defendant because even though the defendant was wearing the same brand of shoe that kicked in the door of the burglarized resident, which was testimony that came in another way anyway, it didn't match the defendant. Or it didn't match to the exclusion of all other shoes, it could have made the print. But the DNA was inculpatory. The DNA matched the defendant on the bottle that was thrown from the scene as he ran away when the police showed up, and it was also found on cigarette butts that were found in the car where the stolen goods were found. The defendant doesn't have standing to challenge the issue of notice on the DNA because he received actual notice 3 weeks before trial that witness was not going to be there. Excuse me, I need water. In addition, there's another reason why this court doesn't need to decide this issue, and that is because this evidence, the reports themselves, were entirely cumulative to evidence that was otherwise properly admitted in this case. As I already said, the shoe report was totally cumulative of the fact that the defendant was wearing a K-Swiss shoe. The K-Swiss shoe logo was on the door of the house where the burglary took place.
Well, the witness that was unavailable, what evidence did that witness go to? What was the testimony? Just the DNA?
No, I'm sorry, that was the shoe print.
It was the shoe print.
That was the shoe print. The shoe print, Officer Swanson, who was the responding officer, he testified that the defendant was wearing a K-Swiss logo brand shoe, and that when he went to investigate and process the crime scene, there was a very clear K-Swiss logo on that door before they lifted the print.
Okay, so there are two different witnesses that we're talking about here.
We're talking about two witnesses.
Right.
That's that witness.
Just trying to get it straight.
Pardon me?
Just trying to get it straight.
Well, of course, it's confusing. The DNA report was cumulative to testimony on the results themselves, because what happened was another lab from the CBI, another lab technician who did some of the double-blind testing on this case, she showed up and she testified to the contents of the report. And she testified that the DNA matched the bottle and that the DNA matched the cigarette butts, and that that, and then she testified to all the procedures, and she was cross-examined thoroughly on all of it. And then when the report sought to be admitted, then there was an objection and it was admitted.
Pratt, could you just clear up, maybe it's totally a misimpression that I have. I thought the trial judge, out of the presence of the jury, said something like, there were essentially three reports that were offered through the statute, two of which were basically inconclusive. And then I thought he was referring to the shoe print report, which was key to the identity. Is that wrong? I mean, I certainly haven't read the record, and I'm not trying to.
I think that was my understanding. The fingerprint and the hair report were totally inconclusive. There was nothing there.
But the shoe print was critical to the identity, and that was with the lab.
It was inculpatory in terms of the make of the shoe, but exculpatory in terms of the defendant, because it didn't match him to the exclusion of every other shoe. They couldn't match the shoe print to the defendant's shoe.
Was there a report on the shoe print?
Yes.
And was that live testimony or just a report?
No, the report was admitted, but the foundation witness wasn't really a foundation witness. It was the witness who had taken the print off the door, the person who had photographed the print. And he had to enhance it a little bit to make it visible. He photographed it. But under the statute, if you haven't given notice, that testimony, the report just comes in. You don't even need a foundational witness.
I wasn't thinking of a foundational witness. I was thinking of an expert witness that said, you know, this shoe fits, whatever.
Yes, he did. He showed up and he testified that this was the actual print that was on the door.
So the only person missing was the foundational witness?
The only
the officer that
was
took
the person who
picture?
Actually ran the machine that compared the shoe prints. I believe it's done by machine.
Not the real expert.
Well, I think he is the real expert.
Oh, it's the same guy.
These days, everything's done by machine, more or less. But I'm not sure. Did I answer your question, sir?
Wait, but okay. I'll figure
well, you can
thank you.
But basically, I'm going to blame you. Maybe it's my mistake.
You're basically saying harmless, no prejudice, because the DNA evidence locates him there.
Exactly. You jumped the gun.
Okay, there was 3 weeks' notice of that.
If that's true, then what's the business about the judge saying it's inconclusive? I mean, that's what confuses me.
Are you talking about the trial judge?
Yeah.
I think he was talking about the hair and the fingerprint evidence. I think those were
not the DNA.
No, the DNA was a definite match.
But you're not relying entirely on harmless. I think you didn't quite intend to say that, right? You don't think there was error here in the first place.
Yes. What I'm trying to say is that these reports themselves are totally cumulative to other evidence. So this court, if it chooses to do so, doesn't need to reach the issue of the admissibility of the reports themselves or the confrontation issues surrounding the reports themselves, because other evidence rendered these reports either harmless in the case of the shoe print or not plain error in
all
the
right.
case of...
Well, let's assume that we're going to get to that main issue. Why doesn't Mendoza take care of it all?
It does. It takes care of it 100% on its face, because there is really no distinction between this case and Hinojosa Mendoza. In Hinojosa Mendoza, the counsel up and just said, I didn't know the statute was there. In this case, the defense lawyer said, well, I thought I only applied to preliminary hearings. And then she later came back and said, you know, it's put in a certain place that I misapprehended its provision, because it was in the place where we talk about, I think it's how you retain and store DNA evidence, or how much has to be retained. And so she said she was confused by its placement. But basically, it's the same thing. If counsel doesn't understand the statute, that's the same thing as not knowing it was there in the first place. So Hinojosa Mendoza, on its face, takes care of this.
Now, Hinojosa Mendoza was cited by Melendez-Diaz.
Yes, it was, twice.
But, okay, talk to me about that citation, please.
Okay.
The Supreme Court cited the Colorado Supreme Court.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, and it did in a very interesting time context, too, which I want to talk about, which is that the cert petition on Hinojosa Mendoza went up at the same time as Melendez-Diaz. The Supreme Court decided Melendez-Diaz and then denied cert in Hinojosa Mendoza 4 days later. So it had the issue, all the issues that the defense raised this morning, it had all those issues in front of it in terms of personal waiver, in terms of the statute, all of these issues. then it denied cert. In Melendez-Diaz, it says two things, and they're basically dicta, because Melendez-Diaz deals with the two issues. Our lab reports testimonial, which Inez Mendoza found they were, it said they were. And then it dealt with the New Jersey procedure, which was rather abrupt. In New Jersey, you can just have a sworn affidavit with the results, and that comes in as though that just comes into testimony as prima facie evidence of what it is. And then there are other provisions in the statute otherwise in New Jersey that allow the defense to bring in witnesses, subpoena witnesses, if they want to cross-examine them. And the Supreme Court in Melendez-Diaz said, that's not enough. You put too much of a burden on the defendant if you make him call those witnesses. And I think Scalia said something very illuminating. He said, it's of no use to the defendant when the witness is unavailable or the witness refuses to appear. And then in dicta, it starts talking about, I'm getting to your question, it starts talking about other statutes that are proper notice and demand statutes. And it says there are other, it's responding to a complaint that this is going to hamstring forensic science forever because lab analysts are going to be too busy testifying. And they said, in answer to that question, no, there are many other states that have adopted the constitutional rule that we have adopted today, cite Inez Mendoza and our statute. And then in another place, it approves of it by saying it's perfectly proper to allow the defense or to ask the defense to exercise this right before trial. And then it cites Inez Mendoza and its statute with approval. So in both of those places, I mean, whatever indication we're getting from the Supreme Court in terms of Inez Mendoza, it's good. It says it's good. It's a good procedure. It's fine to put a little bit of a burden on the defendant to exercise his right to confrontation.
Excuse me, Ms. Pratt, what was confusing to me is it sort of, see, I don't disagree with your rendition of Justice Scalia, but it seems like the language indicates that you ought to have some sort of notice and demand statute. You know, he approves of the pretrial confrontation and so forth, as you described. Do you not read that?
I don't read that into it at all. I mean, I think he approved of it, but then he also says, look, I'm not here to look at every single statute in the United States and determine whether it's constitutional or not. Suffice it to say, a simple notice and demand statute is fine. But here, in this particular case, this isn't a good case for this because the defense got notice. It got notice by discovery that the reports were there. There's no question that he didn't get notice here. And he got notice on the specific DNA witness that she wasn't going to be available in time to give notice 10 days before trial that he actually wanted her there. So in this case, there is, this just isn't a good foundational case.
Do you if we were to read, agree with you about your reading of Melendez-Diaz, is the notice just in the discovery adequate to assuming that I'm sure it was, you know, tendered. Is that adequate constitutionally?
Yes.
That's the notice that the defense has to have to trigger the obligation of the statute.
The statute is notice that the defense has to give.
No, I mean that they see that there's a report, you know,
yes,
so and so said.
Discovery is totally adequate, plus there's a built-in sanction. So if the report doesn't come and there is an actual report, then it can be requested and there can be a sanction and you know, it has
to. Oh, you see this argument as basically trying to get us to impose a litany that the trial court has to go through regarding knowing and voluntary waiver by counsel.
No, I don't think this is a personal waiver situation at all. I think this is a situation where counsel can waive it by inaction. And I think the critical point that I haven't really gotten to in my presentation is if there is a problem that counsel relied on discovery to his client's detriment, that defense counsel should have known this or that counsel was misled, that counsel shouldn't have done this, that this was critical to the case, et cetera, that's for a 35C hearing where an evidentiary hearing can be held and the full record can be developed because this isn't a direct appeal issue. What we look at here is whether or not our statute correctly protects the defendant's confrontational rights.
You know, in regard to that point, isn't it better to solve the problem first?
Well, that's, I mean,
if rather than, you know, have someone, I mean, let's assume there really is some problem for a minute. would be better to deal with that upfront, wouldn't it? Not wait until 35C.
Are you talking about a council problem?
Yes. Particularly in this kind of thing.
I don't see that that's a problem. I think it affords the defendant a total remedy that he can have a new trial if it turns out that he, that counsel did something here that was constitutionally insufficient.
It would be a little hard to do that without a record as
that's
well.
Correct.
And we really don't know too much about the state of mind of the attorney, do we?
Exactly.
Just that there was this situation.
Exactly. And she just had a split second to make a very small record. And I think in all fairness to the defendant, I think you really want to have this full-blown evidentiary hearing that a 35C would afford. For the reasons that I've just discussed, the people respectfully request that the decision of the Court of Appeals be affirmed. Thank you.
I want to start out by clarifying Chief Justice Bender's question about the real witness. Yes, the expert did not testify. The expert that rendered the opinion that said that the shoe print report could have, or the shoe could have made the impression on the front door, was not available to testify. And that was the only evidence tying my client directly to the crime scene. The DNA evidence was found in the car across the street from the crime scene, and we presented evidence at trial that explained why that DNA would be in the car, the owner of the car that said he transported my client. Regarding Rule 16, providing notice, I don't think that can be reconciled with the other provisions of Rule 16, specifically the witness endorsement provision, which says you're intending to call these witnesses, or the expert disclosure, discretionary disclosure, which says, you know, the court can require disclosure of the underlying data, and that the reason for it is to provide defense counsel with, or defendant with,
excuse
meaningful
me.
Information.
Sorry, your time is about up, okay. So you can finish your sentence.
All right, to conduct cross-examination. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thank both parties for their argument. The case will stand submitted.